right, it's time for Ask the Pastor or the Professor or the Bioethics Expert. Probably some other titles in there somewhere. I can't remember them all. We just call him Dr. Bob. That's what we call him. Morning, Dr. Weiss.
Good morning.
Are we catching up with you somewhere on the road?
No, actually, I'm here at home just taking it easy. I have class today at 2 and then one at 6 to 8. But we're here with Jan. She was home from the hospital, so...
Yeah, I heard that Jan had some health issues. Can you talk about that at all? Or?
Sure. Her blood pressure spiked, and so she had to go.
Bob, were you making Jan frustrated again?
Not really. No, and so anyway, she spiked pretty high blood pressure, and then we took her by ambulance from Glendale Lutheran into the hospital Wednesday afternoon.
So is she okay now?
Well, she's got some tests to do on Wednesday. To see what's going on. So far, they haven't tracked anything down yet. So it's just...
So you welcome the prayers of God's people.
So when Diane called, I actually had forgotten about today because just too many irons in the fire thinking about that. And so at any rate...
I can see where you'd be preoccupied.
Yeah, just a little bit. So, but anyway, we're here, and at least good memory just short when these kinds of things happen. So...
Well, thanks for joining us. Our numbers here are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. If you'd like to bring a question or make a comment here on our Ask the Professor Bible study, there is a story out of Washington today. This is one of those things that just seems to me to be more and more difficult to distinguish, I guess is the word that I would use. The story from the Associated Press says, on the eve of hearings today on legalized same-sex marriage in Washington, D.C., local pastors have demanded that voters be allowed to decide the issue in a referendum. City leaders in Washington, D.C. have rejected that, calling it a civil rights issue that shouldn't be on the ballot. But hundreds turned out yesterday for a rally in downtown Washington chanting, "Let the people vote." Bishop Harry Jackson said he believed God might still, quote, do a miracle, unquote, and change the minds of council members who previously voted to recognize same-sex marriages performed elsewhere. A counter-protester near the rally said the solution might be for governments to perform only civil unions, with marriage available as an additional religious ceremony for those who want it. So we have an issue that is bitterly divided in the secular side of the equation and bitterly divided on the ecclesiastical side of the equation. If it weren't difficult enough to sort out as just a secular issue, now the pastors are showing up yesterday in Washington, D.C., and they're praying that God will get involved. Can you help straighten this out for me?
God's already involved. I realize that if this whole thing, I mean, there's been quite a bunch of uproar on D.C. on same-sex marriage, and what happens, of course, is the Congress has to vote, and if they vote for it, since they're the ones that legislate what goes on in Washington, D.C., then it's going to be like a tactical nuclear. Then everybody's going to want it if the Senate and the House go for it. So I think that the gay activists applauded the D.C. Council for they passed it 12-1, and of course, as you said, the local ministers say the battle's not over, but God is already involved. He's been involved in the Old and New Testament, just simply to say that homosexuality and its attendant same-sex marriage issues are a sin, and if one practices that and continues to practice apart from confession and absolution, then they continue to live in sin, as anyone continues to live whatever sin they're committing. But this one certainly takes more of a focus because it is more public. It is in the news. You can go to any website and just type in same-sex marriage in Washington, D.C., and you get all kinds of hookups for that. So God's already, especially Romans 1:20, 26, 27, where, as you well know, and your listeners perhaps know, that God considers this an abomination when you exchange natural for unnatural. This is not the way God intended this. Even natural law, when you talk with Atheists for Life, or you talk with Gay and Lesbians for Life, they understand, and a lot of them don't want to be married because they have more than, in 1 year, they'll have more than 250 to 300 partners. So even against the gay and lesbians, this is railing against some of what they're thinking of. So God's involved. I mean, it's I mean, this is one of the clearest issues in the scriptures in terms of what people think, you know, God says, but their reasons in terms of, well, God made me this way, or it's the genetics issue, or God loves the sinner and hates the sin, and that's a half-truth. So all of this stuff is, I think, is next to what goes on in, well, I don't want to bring up any other issues, but I think this issue here with same-sex marriage, and now the new term, Chuck, that your listeners may find this sort of patronizing again to the heterosexual marriage of a husband and a wife, is opposite-sex marriage. So there, again, once they are diluting and softening the terminology, you soften and dilute the doctrines and the teachings of the Bible to the point where people are basically saying, hey, it doesn't affect me, it doesn't impact me, but it does.
Well, I want to put this story together with another story that is coming from Fox News in Chicago. I know that, Pastor Weiss, you're not in the habit of hanging out in the bar there, so you may never have heard of a Chicago bar called Mother's. It's a well-known bar in Chicago, and it has been accused of racism. The reporter on this story is Sandra Solarte, and she writes, a well-known bar in Chicago's Gold Coast is being accused of racism. Some college students from St. Louis say they were barred from going in, and they're not buying the reason that they got. This is about a senior trip for nearly 200 students from Washington University here in St. Louis, which is just a hop, skip, and a jump from your location here on Concordia Seminary.
Right.
Trip organizers are angry at the treatment they got at Mother's on Division. Six African-American men in the group were denied entry into the bar last weekend. Student Regis Nurari says the bar's management told them their jeans were too baggy, but Murari didn't buy it. So he switched jeans with a shorter white student. The white student, who now has very baggy jeans on, was admitted, and Murari was still kept out. The students held a protest in front of Mother's last Sunday, and there's a meeting about this issue coming up in St. Louis apparently today. The students are considering a lawsuit. So apparently, based on this story, and we have the facts as the reporter has assembled them for us, civil rights is not a settled question here in the United States of America, particularly in an urban setting like Chicago. Now, we have this civil rights issue in Chicago, and we have what the city leaders claim is a civil rights issue in Washington, D.C., as it pertains to gay marriage. Are they similar? Are they identical? Are they dissimilar? How do you see it?
I see them as dissimilar. My explanation for something like this regarding the history of the civil rights movement in the United States, I mean, African Americans know this much better than I do, obviously. I'm just a white guy. But to go back to the days of slavery that, I mean, you're going back to the 16, 17, 1800s, all the way down through Dr. Martin Luther King's day and beyond, where they did not have, quote-unquote, the rights, you know, to eat in restaurants where whites were, use the same restrooms as whites, sit in the back of the bus like Rosa Parks, you know, when she sat up in the front, which was, of course, one of the catapults of bringing this whole issue of discrimination because of color to the forefront. Now, discrimination because of sexual orientation is not the same thing as discrimination for color. Homosexuals can eat at the same restaurants as heterosexuals, because most of the time you never know. They certainly, in spite of what they say, they can visit in hospitals. They can go see, you know, they're not locked out of hospitals in spite of what they're saying. They can do anything they want to do.
But they can't get married.
They can get married in 6 states.
Well, that would mean they can't get married in 44 states.
They cannot get married in 44 states.
And they would say, there you have evidence of discrimination.
But
why is discrimination wrong in Chicago on the in the mother's bar situation, but it's not discrimination in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I think what your initial question was in terms of civil rights, you know,
correct,
the civility of this whole issue, and what is a civil right? We go to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, doesn't address the whole issue of marriage at all. It just isn't there.
Would I be correct to assume that 20-somethings, 30-somethings have a tendency to see the gay marriage issue clearly as a civil rights / discrimination issue, just as those of us who can remember the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s viewed those questions, that discrimination, through a civil rights lens? Perhaps you, Dr. Weiss, don't see it that way, but I think the 20-somethings and 30-somethings see them as almost identical. Right or wrong? Am I right or wrong?
I agree that in the broad sense of looking at what is permitted and what isn't permitted in terms of people who are gay or lesbian. In other words, what are they not permitted to do? Well, in the United States, except for, you know, in 44 states, they're not permitted to marry. They may have unions, and they can have as many partners as they want in all 50 states. But only in 6 states are they permitted to marry. So the problem with that even that flies in the face of civil rights is that no black person in any of, at this time in the 60s, the 48 contiguous states we have, no black person was permitted to eat in any white restaurant across the United States. So that comparison falls flat on its face from my viewpoint, because we're dealing with the absolute versus the non-absolute. That is, heterosexual marriage is not an absolute and forbidden in all 50 states.
So a young man comes out of high school, and he enters college and graduates from college at age 21, 22, maybe 23. And then he comes to Concordia Seminary at the fairly tender age of, say, 22 years old. Does it happen here at Concordia Seminary that the young men who are seeking to be pastors tend to see the gay marriage thing from a civil rights perspective, at least maybe not in their Christian background, but certainly that's what the culture has been telling them almost all of their lives?
Well, I agree. I think that they're looking at it this way, but I really think, and I'm not an attorney, but I do think that this is dragging in what happened to the American black people, where they had no rights, to be quite frank. They could not do what homosexuals can do. Even in between 1920 and 1972, the eugenic movement in the United States, which sterilized over 80,000 people, was attempting to prohibit the marriage between blacks and whites, between Native Americans and black and Native Americans and whites. Those were rights of the civil law that were violated. And, of course, that was stopped, unfortunately. It took too long back in the 70s. And certainly with Dr. Martin Luther King, the laws of prohibiting black people to do what they were had the right to do based on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence, all of those were stopped. So I really do think, and I certainly would hold my ground on this, that even though many of them perceive this to be a civil right because that's how it is being projected, I think if one takes a look at what is a civil right and you define that based on the law, of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, you're going to find that homosexuality, that is, same-sex marriage, has nothing to do with the civil rights, because they have all these rights. And there's no civil right that conjoins marriage to it. It is not part of a civil right. It is a state right that if you want to be married, it's up to the state to determine who gets married and who doesn't. In 6 states, they've determined that gays can be married. In 44 states, they have determined they can't be married.
So you've got 5 daughters. Most of them still in their 20s, aren't they?
Well, four of them are.
4 of them in their 20s?
Yeah.
All bright
young. Take it back. 3 out of the 4, sorry.
All right.
Hard to keep track these days.
3 out of your 5 daughters are in their 20s, mm-hmm. interacting in their societal arena, the culture of their friends.
Mm-hmm.
It has probably happened to them or in their circle.
Right.
That somebody has made an aggressive case in defense of the so-called civil right of gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that if you disagree with the person who advocates that, they take a dim view. It may even spoil a relationship. Part of that flows from an understanding of history that preceded the 20-somethings. But they've seen the footage. They understand on the Martin Luther King holiday when they watch the Learning Channel, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
that there was a period of history in our country that was profoundly discriminatory. And it was wrong. And mm-hmm. people can, 20-somethings can look back on that now and ask us, what were you thinking? And now they look at the champions of civil rights and those who prevailed in that debate, rightly so, and they sort of identify themselves as a champion or a leader in the same context, only this time the civil rights discrimination issue is gay marriage. Now, how would you, given that predisposition on the part of that 20-something, which is maybe even tending to be aggressive, how would Dr. Bob Weiss wade into that debate so as to come out with something of a productive outcome?
Okay, let's shorten that down to a question.
The question is, confronted with I don't want to use the term self-righteous because that carries a negative connotation, but conducted with a self-righteous 20-something who defends gay marriage with the same kind of fervor that they saw
civil rights
leaders defend civil rights in the 50s and 60s, an aggressive posture, how would you, obviously not in agreement with them, how would you enter that debate? How would you conduct yourself in that debate?
Well, first thing that I would not do is to get into the legal debate of this, whether it's a civil right or not a civil right. I think too many of us we know how to get into trouble, but we don't know how to get out of trouble. That is to say, in terms of sticking to my vocation as a pastor, as a teacher, a professor, I would stick to what I know, not what I don't know, nor would I get into things, well, I know a little bit about this, and I know a little bit about law, and I have an opinion of what I perceive to be a civil right or not to be a civil right in this area. But I would simply, from my viewpoint, and I think this is where I think a lot of Christians need to go, in spite of wanting to try and debate and argue this whole issue, is to go in what is a right in terms of God's sight in regarding marriage, regarding our human sexuality, regarding, from our viewpoint, the distinction of law and gospel. And if they say, well, I don't want to hear any of that stuff, there you go, you're stuffing the religious stuff down to me. But this is what I know, and this is what my Christian witness is all about. This tends to rattle the cages of a lot of people because the natural law, I believe, which we need more discussion on in the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, would simply convict them that they do believe that if you take a look at a man and a woman, they are, to be quite frank, and I'm not trying to get too anatomical here, they are different. Obviously, that's needless to say. And that when two people who are of the same sex want to marry, marry. They're marrying, you know, different parts of their anatomy. No, they're marrying the same parts. And even natural law would say this is not, quote-unquote, natural. Even Darwin would speak against this whole issue in terms of why do we have homosexuals, in terms of where did they come from and why did they survive. And he would simply say, well, they have their own small little niche, and they're sort of living in this nest and trying to survive, and that's why there's only 1 to 2% of them, quote-unquote, left. So I would stick to what I know, and that is the theology of the Bible, the theology of creation, the first article, and then that, of course, would take me into the marriage of one flesh union. I think we can all go off into and debate the issue, is homosexuality a civil right, or isn't it a civil right? I personally think it's a cloaking issue where they're using something to drive the emotions, because that's what you're tapping into, where you see people and they get very emotional still when they go back and see what happened in the 50s, the 60s, even before that. You have the movie Roots, which is still, you can be bought and sold, you know, like at the Blockbuster. And people see that and they get very emotional. And so now you thrust homosexuality. It's almost like a layering. You layer that over, like you do in a PowerPoint presentation, over the black civil rights. You say, oh, yeah, they are the same. No, they're not the same. I don't think anybody, even black people, don't believe they're the same. Talk to them. Get them on the stage. They are not the same thing. But I do believe that the whole emotional issue is being used and played. The card is being played here in terms of the civil rights of African Americans, not the legal issue, but it's the emotional stuff that they're playing on. And I think that's the weak link.
Here's another story. This story comes from yesterday, and it comes out of Los Angeles. Authorities say a 37-year-old Los Angeles man has been arrested on suspicion of murder for the death of an unborn child believed to be his. Police said in a press release that Joshua Woodward was arrested yesterday in Los Angeles, is being held on $2 million bail in a county jail. Police say the arrest came after an investigation on Monday revealed, quote, suspicious circumstances of a miscarriage, unquote. Investigators estimate the fetus was in its 13th week. Police released no information on the mother or the circumstances of the child's death. The release says Woodward is believed to have ties to Miami and Chicago, and detectives are also seeking information in those cities. Investigators are set to present the case to prosecutors tomorrow. My question for you, Dr. Weiss, on the other side of this break is, what's the big deal? The child was unborn. It's legal to kill unborn children in this country, isn't it?
It is legal, but it's not permitted by God's word, but it is legal.
All right, let's talk about it on the other side of the break. You're listening to the Bible Study, Ask the Pastor. Dr. Bob Weiss with us here today. Numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back. Here at AM 850 KFUO, as we look forward to our anniversary on December 14th, we are so grateful to our partners who have become anniversary underwriters in 2009. We say thanks to Concordia Publishing House, publishing works of inspiration and faith for more than 139 years, and Lutheran Senior Services, specializing in enhancing life for seniors at 19 locations in Missouri and Illinois. Thanks for celebrating with us on the occasion of our 85th anniversary year.
Did you know that one of the easiest ways to listen to one of our KFUO Radio podcasts is through the iTunes Store? Search KFUO Radio on iTunes, choose your favorite program, and then hit select. That's it. It really is that easy. If you don't use iTunes, you can get the code for your podcast software through our website at kfuo.org. Listen to our podcast programs on the web, on your smartphone, on the radio, and on the go anywhere in the world. We're KFUO Radio.
Turtles with built-in compasses? Learn about it next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moment host, Ian Taylor.
When it comes to sailing the seas, the compass was one of man's greatest inventions. That's why researchers were surprised when it was discovered that some bacteria had tiny, built-in compasses. But these compasses are simple affairs. Now it has been discovered that loggerhead turtles not only have a built-in compass, but use it to pinpoint their location. The Earth's magnetic field encounters the Earth's surface at differing angles depending on where you are. Young loggerhead turtles must stay within the ocean current system that surrounds the Sargasso Sea in the center of the Atlantic. And when they get so far north in this current system that they might leave it, they turn south and return to a more central location within that system. When they get too far south, they turn north. To see if the turtles could actually sense their location based on magnetic fields, researchers tested loggerheads in tanks surrounded by electric coils. When they simulated magnetic conditions on the northern end of the turtle's boundary, the turtle swam south. When they simulated magnetic conditions at the southern boundary, the turtle swam north. If the loggerhead's navigation system evolved slowly over millions of years, it would have been of no survival value to the turtles until it was complete. Since the turtles would have had a very low survival rate without it, their navigational system bears witness to the all-wise, powerful Creator who made all things.
To get a complete set of transcripts from Creation Moments programs, ask about the book Letting God Create Your Day when you visit us online at creationmoments.com. Or give us a call at 1-800-42-BIBLE. And join us again for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
People in our area know that if they're looking for good family entertainment, they can always go to Branson. What they may not know is that Branson is coming to our area. The Best of Branson is on the road and will stop in Grafton on Saturday, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Grafton Elementary School. Branson on the Road brings the tradition of family fun a little closer to home for local families to enjoy. Tickets can be purchased at the Alton Regional Convention and Visitors Bureau. That's Branson on the Road, November 14th.
Underwriting on AM 850 KFUO, provided by Reliable Heating and Cooling. Christian people who understand the value of bringing you God's Word on the radio. The folks at Reliable also know how important it is to have your furnace checked before winter. An inefficient or deteriorating heat exchanger costs you needless expense and could be dangerous. A preseason inspection from Reliable is convenient, affordable, and gives you peace of mind. Reliable Heating and Cooling, supporting the broadcast ministry of AM 850 KFUO.
This is our Ask the Professor Bible study today. Dr. Bob Wise, professor at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, is our guest. He has expertise in the area of bioethics as well. We talked just before we went to the break about a story out of Los Angeles where a 37-year-old Los Angeles man has been arrested on suspicion of murder for the death of an unborn child. The bail here is $2 million, so they don't want this guy to take off. And crass as it is, I have to ask the question, what's the problem? How many unborn children do we kill in America every day, Dr. Weiss?
About 4,000. I have that case in front of me, by the way.
4,001, what's the difference?
Yeah, and the difference here, of course, is our inconsistency in our law. This man's 37 years old, $2 million, he's sitting in jail. They got a number down here. If anybody knows anything, let them know what's going on. They wouldn't keep him if they suspected that this was beyond, as they say here, suspicious circumstances of a miscarriage, which means, we don't know. I mean, maybe he hit the lady. I don't know if the lady is alive, she must be, I don't know, but the death of an unborn child. It's interesting that they use the word unborn child at 13 weeks.
Why do you think that's interesting?
Well, because Roe v. Wade does not define, nor do they get into, in the case that Justice Blackmun wrote the opinion, which is about 13 pages in 1973 in January. He doesn't get into the issue of whether or not the child in the womb is a real person or not. He avoids it, although he does, I should say, come up with the answer that since the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, including the Bill of Rights, always address a person as an adult, that is, any time they deal with the word person, it's always focused on outside the womb. Therefore, what's inside the womb can't be associated with what's outside the womb, if you get my drift, as they say.
Yeah.
So therefore, Roe v. Wade came down, as we all know, that says you can kill a child, murder a child, literally, from the point of conception all the way through the 9 months, the 38 to 42 weeks. Now, frequently, states will determine at what point that can be done. Some states require certain legal issues if it's beyond or into the second trimester, but Roe v. Wade does give any state the opportunity for a woman who so chooses to believe that this child is unnecessary or a burden on their life to have this child murdered and removed. Now, the law, of course, says that if you murder a child that is in the womb, then now that could be a manslaughter, one, two. I'm not an attorney, but it can be subject to that simply because this child, now this is what attorneys have told me, that this child is literally, quote-unquote, put this in double quotes, the property of the woman. This is her child. She owns this child. So when this child has been removed by murder, in this case, then the law would say we have to find out if this was intentional, unintended consequence, and that will determine what position, if this is in fact a murder, how it would be addressed in the courts. So, but a woman can go to the other corner across the street, you know, and then they can have the abortion removed because the law says you can do this. So this is an incredible inconsistency in our law.
I know that you see it as an inconsistency. I know that you would mediate against it. What is, play the devil's advocate for me here. What does the other side say? How do you explain being just quite all right with a woman visiting the abortion clinic and having her 13-week fetus killed, but holding a man in suspicion of murder at $2 million bail because he killed an unborn fetus? How do they defend that?
Well, it's just like we said, they can defend going into a Planned Parenthood clinic on Forest Park Avenue because that's the law. They can, they can do that. They've been given that, here's the word, the freedom and the right to choose whether or not the child in their womb can live or die at their decision.
Well, we know it's the law, and it used to be the law that black people couldn't eat in the restaurant either. Even though that was the law, most folks, I think, would say, but the law was wrong. So is that the best they got?
That's the best they got. Now, you know, many people do believe, what is the latest poll, and I know polls can be viewed one way or the other, but the latest poll is saying that 54% of people in the United States oppose abortion, that is, abortion, except for rape and incest. Now, then they would say that's okay to go ahead and have an abortion if a person has been raped or incestually violated. Back to your original question then we have, of course, a person who murders a child, and they call this an unborn child. Well, it seems to me that the Los Angeles newspaper here, I don't know if this is the Los Angeles Times or not, but they tend to be more on the liberal side, but regardless, to call this an unborn child is giving away the position of this particular news item, at least what I'm looking at, and what you have read, that says this is a human being. And so in that sense, I think they're playing into, you can't murder a fetus, but you can murder a child. That's the point in terms of the law. So the law calls it an unborn child because it's the property of the woman, and she can do with it what she wants.
It's the property of the woman.
It's the property. So if you remove the property of this woman, that is what really belongs to her, then the punishment's going to fit the crime. This is the old law of the claw that goes way back to Roman law. This goes back, and people can look this up in Exodus 21, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. So in this case, the punishment could be many, many years in prison without parole. Who knows? It depends on what the state laws are for this particular, in California, on this.
So when you say the unborn child is the property of the woman, are you speaking, and I realize you've already admitted that you're not an attorney, are you speaking from a philosophical perspective or a legal perspective?
I'm speaking from the whole issue of the 14th Amendment due process, which gives a person freedom to do with their quote-unquote body the way they choose it. And it, within the context of that, when one looks at, I'm going to throw out some amendments here to the Constitution, the 4th, 5th, the 9th, and the 14th, all of those together, at least as I have been told by attorneys, talk about property rights. And this child belongs to this woman. And so I find it, and I've always found this interesting, and just...
Why is the child the property of the woman and not the property of the man? Because if the child is the property of the man, then the 37-year-old Los Angeles guy should be able to dispose of his property.
He should be, but it's not considered that because the woman is carrying the baby. The woman is taking care of the baby. The nourishment is, you know, it's in her body. It's not in the man's body. And they're not going to discriminate. And here we go with that phrase again. They're not going to differentiate in terms of the genetics, that the man's genetics is responsible for 50% of the genome of this child, you know, 23 chromosomes, and then the man's genome made this child either a man or a woman child, a boy or a girl child, and they're not going to do that.
I thought we were beyond the point in this country where one person could be the property of another person.
Not according to the law. So, I mean, this is, again, infuriates so many people that are pro-life because on one corner you can go into an abortion clinic and take the life of a child. On the other corner, if you shoot a woman who is pregnant and she survives, the child dies, or let's say both die, now you got a double case of manslaughter because this is now considered part of her. And so they always call this, and this happened in St. Louis about 5 or 6 years ago when a young lady leaving a bus was shot. The child in her womb died, and she survived. And I and several other people, I remember writing into them, and they published this in the Post-Dispatch, that they were calling, the grandmother, quote-unquote, lost her fetus child, lost the fetus. And then I and a whole bunch of people apparently got on the phone and wrote some letters and said, now, wait a minute. In one paragraph, you call this a child. Then you call it a fetus. Make your mind up. What is it based on the law? Well, then all of a sudden they came out and said, well, this is a child. Because to murder a fetus is a nondescript term in Roe v. Wade that says it really isn't a person. So to say it's a child now gives it an identity, a human identity. And when it has a human identity based on the law, as I've been told, then this human identity yields to the law.
Sometimes when we're so wedded, so tightly clinging to our sin, we're willing to accept some inconsistencies in our logic just as long as at the end of the day we are able to do what it is we want to do. But as new generations of people begin to consider the logic of these arguments and the obvious inconsistency that you pointed out, are there some young people who are saying, doesn't follow? Maybe they weren't caught up in the feminism movement of the 60s and the 70s and the bra burning business, and now they're just looking at the logic of the question. Is that working in favor of unborn children or not?
I think it is working in the favor of unborn children. I do believe that what young people are seeing in terms of the inconsistency, and my opinion is that we need to play more on that. We tend to ignore that, and I'm really very happy you brought this up because this does demonstrate an inner inconsistency in our law that says we can't have our cake and eat it too, that the ends don't justify the means. And so when young people say, now wait a minute, you mean if you take the life of this child while it's in the womb of this mother, that's murder. But it, you can walk into an abortion clinic and take the life of this child because the mother doesn't want it, and that's okay. Now, wait a minute here. Something isn't right. So what's happening here is the natural law, that which God has given to us in our heart, that says, you know, you just don't take the life of anybody, whether you even think they're potential or not potential human. that just doesn't make sense. And so what this inconsistency demonstrates is the natural law is present in all of us, and they're saying, wait a minute, something's not right here. So I really think, and I do this when I talk to people, I bring up these stories, these inconsistency stories, that the law says yes, and then the law says, no, no, wait a minute. And so people tend to gravitate to this and it moves their thinking. And so now we're structuring their thinking more on a natural law way without even dealing with theology. So we're going back to your question in terms of homosexuality, and now this case where we're dealing with, well, just take a look at a man and a woman in general, how they're made and what they're made for together. And now we're talking about a child in the womb with a mother. In one sense, it's murder. In the other sense, it's not. Now, wait a minute. Things just don't add up, as they say.
At some point, we all have to ask ourselves whether we want the truth or whether we don't. And if it's the truth that we want, then we have to deal with the inconsistencies, because if there is inconsistency, then somewhere there is falsehood. And if you eliminate the options that lead to falsehood, then you're left with a fairly clear conclusion. And that is, unborn children are people, they're persons, and they deserve as much right to life as any of the rest of us. And I don't think you have to work too hard to come to that conclusion, Dr. Weiss.
No, that's really, really good. You should come over to the seminary and talk more. No, I'm serious. That is good,
trouble.
Chuck. No. Well, we both could, I suppose. But that is very good, because if you just ask anybody, and this is kind of back to kind of a non-theological thing. You work with people in this area, and they support abortion. I'm not a fan of the word pro-choice. I mean, you're pro-abortion or you're pro-life. There's no middle of the road. And when somebody says, you know, why can't they make their decision? If they don't want this child and they can't handle it, why can't they do this? Well, certainly the law says. And then what I like to do is ask this person who seems to be, as they say, pro-choice, let me just ask you one. Were you ever in the womb, put it this way, of your mother? Were you ever there? Well, of course I was. Oh, so they're using a personal pronoun, I, which establishes what you just talked about, that this is a person, a human being. So you're saying you did exist. Well, of course I did. Well, that means, you know, do you exist any differently other than you have, you know, you're just taller and bigger now? You know, you're not in a womb, but you're outside the womb. Well, then they're going to try and skirt the issue. So then, well, tell me, at what point did you start to become a human being? And then what was it that made you that? And they're going to fall flat on that, I guarantee you. And that has nothing to do, I mean, even though our faith informs our science, and clearly they both do agree in this issue, that you're a human in the womb, they tend to fall flat on their face on this, and they get pretty upset when they're confronted with a non-theological discussion. And it takes them off guard, because they're expecting, like somebody like me that teaches this stuff, you know, to start burying them with all kinds of Hebrew, Greek, theological quotes. And I tend not to do that. That's why I like St. Paul in the Areopagus, the God of Thunder, when he goes in there and he says, oh, I see you have this unknown God. Well, let me tell you about my God. And he doesn't go after them. He doesn't grind his axe in the pulpit. He just speaks very clear the Word of God.
All right, let me bring up one more subject here before we run out of time in this hour of Ask the Pastor. Yesterday was Reformation Sunday in my church, and it appeared that the pastor was quite animated about that. He thought it was a pretty big deal. We know that the anniversary of the Reformation is October 31st, which is coming up yet this week. And so there are some folks who might have the Reformation on their mind. Efforts on the part of a number of different reformers to correct what they thought were errors in the church of their day. So now we have this story coming from the Associated Press from Kahului, Hawaii. And I'm interested in your comment. A foot bone the bone from a foot from Hawaii's first saint is making a tour of the islands just weeks after Father Damien was canonized by Pope Benedict in Rome. The relic was carried to several parishes on Maui Saturday, including the one where the Roman Catholic priest, born in Belgium, was called to serve leprosy patients quarantined in 1973. He went on to minister to people with leprosy for 16 years on Molokai, where the heel bone will arrive later in the week after stops in Lanai and Kauai. After its tour of the islands, the relic, housed in a small tin box inside a larger wooden container, will be placed at the Cathedral of Our Lady of Peace in Honolulu, where Damien was ordained in 1864. My question for you, Dr. Weiss, is does the Reformation have anything to say to this?
Yeah, it says that, well, speaking in a pastoral voice here, I have that in front of me, too, as well, the relic to make mainland island stops before final placement.
Boy, you're really on the ball here.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to try and stay up with what you're doing here as much as you can. Yeah, the right heel bone. It's going to be enshrined Our Lady of the Peace, you know, as you mentioned, when he was ordained in 1864. The bone in and of itself is simply a bone. I mean, it's not going to save anybody, and I think anybody that looks at this would say it's not. If the Roman Church wants to canonize this man, that's their business. And that obviously, you know, to canonize this relic from the right heel bone because of what this man did, it goes back to the Reformation when Martin Luther would say, look, you know, you got all these saints, you've done all this stuff, you've got the, you know, supposedly a thorn from the crown of Christ. None of this stuff has ever been demonstrated to save anybody from sin, death, and the power of the devil. Praying to a relic, and now this is going to really maybe tick some people off, but really is not theologically, biblically based. The Lord says, you know, talk to me. You pray to me. Cast your cares to me, not to bones, not to relics. And so from that standpoint, this is what, of course, Luther was militating against, where even some people were paying to see these relics and making, and they were collecting money. And this, of course, is usury. This is not what anything that one could demonstrate or prove in the Bible. It just doesn't exist. And so, to me, to talk about what this man did as a Christian, this Father Damien, and how he worked with people and amongst people, what this says to me is what Luther wrote in his document, Fleeing the Time of Plague. In other words, you don't leave people, you stick with them. There may be times when you got to go home and take care of your family, but certainly Father Damien was not married. But to me, his legacy is the pastoral care that he gave to people who were suffering from this Hansen's disease that is talked about, at least in what I have in front of me, in leprosy. I mean, to me, that's the witness that people ought to be talking about.
If I were a 15th century, 16th century person and had quite a collection of relics in those medieval times, what is it that I thought that I had?
I think you thought you had a piece of salvation history, because they all...
Is it bad to have a piece of salvation history?
If it's not Christ, then what you are doing is grabbing hold of something that is mortal as opposed to Christ, who is certainly immortal within the context of being true God and true man. So that to grab a hold of... you know, a thorn of the Christ of thorn, supposedly from Christ, or any other relics that exist that supposedly happened at the time of Christ or thereafter that people believe have some sort of a divine aspect to them.
Do you think that somebody who has a relic here in the 21st century, like the right heel bone of Father Damien, would say, oh, no, this is the 21st century. We have a much clearer understanding of these things than they did back in the at the time of the Reformation. You can't hold us to that anymore. Would that be the argument?
that may be their argument, but a bone is a bone and a relic is a relic. There is nothing new under the sun when it comes to, praying to relics or using relics as a go-between between God and Jesus. This person has died. He is dead. He is in the ground or someplace. Where his soul is, that's not my disposition. We certainly would pray that, you know, it rests with in the bosom of Abraham. But I think that things have not changed in terms of what Martin Luther was talking about regarding the canonization of people, the deification of relics, to the point where these are things that if one has a view of it or sees it, then it's going to be something of a good work to pray to it or to do it, but one's not saved by that.
So for those of us who sat through Reformation Sunday yesterday and left the church thinking that the Reformation, whatever that was, what it is old. It happened about 500 years ago, and it must have been a pretty big deal back then, but its voice is silent now. Does the Kahului relic bone have something to say in terms of the Reformation?
Yeah, it simply says the bottom line is you're not saved by the things that you do. You're saved by grace through faith alone, which is one of the phrases, of course, that Martin Luther championed from Romans 6:23 and so forth. You're justified by faith apart from works of the law. And the worshiping of relics is a work that does not save. You're saved by grace, not by performing works of praying to relics or worshiping them or thinking that this relic is going to have some great salvific purpose to your life. You're only saved by grace through faith, not a relic.
Dr. Weiss, please give our best wishes to your wife, Jan, and we'll pray for her safe recovery. And God's blessings to you. Thank you for joining us here today.
My pleasure, and God's peace to you and your people.
There. That's Pastor Bob Weiss, Professor Bob Weiss, I guess I should more correctly say, and our conversation here on our Ask the Pastor hour. Tomorrow we will continue in Luke chapter 22. We'll take it up at verse 14. Pastor John Lukowski will have the privilege of discussing Luke's version of the institution of the Lord's Supper, and the Reverend Dr. Victor Belton will be our guest for our Ask the Pastor Hour on Tuesday. Thanks for listening.
Listen to Chuck Ratherton guests Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of The Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.